solve large, intractable problems.
It's a new venture altogether.
Your brain is a wild horse there.
Because remember, writing is not a team sport.
You are not selling horse carriages when there are cars.
I want to be known only as a trusted advisor.
More like a tourist.
Play to Potential Podcast.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to the next episode of Connecting the Dots, a series where we make sense of what we've learned across the 100-plus speakers of the podcast over the last 7 years. This time, we're going to be looking at judgment. If you're new to the podcast, I should mention that we're going through a phase where we are pausing collecting the dots and focusing on connecting them. I hope you find these compilations helpful. In a few months, we will come back to having new guests and adding to our library. This is your host Deepak Jayaraman here. I'm based in Mumbai, and my mission is to help growth-minded individuals play to their unique potential. My primary vocation is that of an executive coach and a sounding board to leaders. However, I realize that my bandwidth is finite, and there are only so many people I can work with at one point in time. Hopefully, this content can make a difference to a wider set of people who are keen on playing to their full potential. To know more, you can visit www.playtopotential.com. Let's dive into the topic for this episode, judgment. Now, I've noticed that judgment is one of those terms that everybody knows is super important, but it also is one of those topics that's nebulous and hard to sometimes capture in a coherent way. In this episode, we try to shine the light on judgment through the various insights we've gleaned in our podcast journey. Let's start with defining what is good judgment. If we start with the observation that life is full of grays and very little is black and white, then the must-have capability to navigate the world of grays is good judgment. In my work as a leadership advisor over the last several years, I noticed that when we look at the ingredients of leadership potential, one of them is judgment. Sudhir Sitapati, author of The CEO Factory, speaks about how Hindustan Unilever looks at judgment, influence, and drive as markers of long-term potential. In the book, you talk about judgment, influence, and drive being the three markers of potential.
Yeah.
But what I found interesting was you go on to say that for the first few years, it's drive, which is sort of the key axis of growth or differentiation, and then it moves to influence, and eventually it's judgment. So talk to us a little bit about this notion of how potential plays out in Unilever. And I'm curious about these inflection points where sort of the needle moves from drive to influence to judgment.
You know, I wrote about judgment, drive, and influence in the context of recruiting people. Because if you recruit for the immediate job at junior management in industry, right, and it's different from professional services, and there's a very vast difference between professional services and industry. In industry, at junior levels, you need drive. But if you recruit the best person for the job, you're not recruiting for the future. So when we recruit management trainees, we have to recruit for junior management, middle management, and senior management. We expect every manager of ours. So at a very early age, we've got to see whether this guy's got the potential to have judgment. Does she have the potential to be influential? Though in the first 5 years, all that's going to determine success, and one of the reasons also we don't judge too early, is that all that the first 7-8 years tells you beyond a point is, or heavily over-indexes in the fact of how driven you are. And it's, you know, only over a period of time that you start working as a team, and that's really where influence comes. And even after that, where you got to start making a decision. It's one of the reasons why we don't promote too early, because if you promote too early, you're promoting on drive. And you're not promoting, and then, you know, a person will hit a barrier very fast and may not have either influencing or judgment skills. So I think that's the important thing on judgment, drive, and influence. I think there are natural inflection points for these within HUL, DJ. I think the first 8-9 years, you know, we call it work level 2, which is kind of where people are really sort of, it's heavily, you know, driven. And as you go a little bit more and more senior, you get some influence and judgment. I guess, you know, in middle management, what we call work level 3, which is gently 10 to 15, 17 years, is where you sort of have to work together as an organization with various functions and other people and get work done. And I guess at senior management, really the success or failure depends on, you know, do you get 7 out of 10 decisions? I used to have a boss who said that anybody who gets 9 or 10 out of 10 decision maker is a bad decision maker.
Not taking enough risk.
A good decision maker has to get 7. He has to get the right 7, but you know, that's the right ratio. 5 is too low, 9 is too high.
Like Sudhir says, I noticed that while we need judgment at every level, it becomes a real differentiator in the upper echelons of the corporate world as you grow in your journey. Before we go too far, I think it's important for us to pin down what is judgment and have some sort of a working definition. In this context, let's hear from Sir Andrew Lickyerman of London Business School, who studied judgment for several years.
It is the ability, combining personal qualities with relevant experience and knowledge, to form an opinion or take a decision. Now, that combination of the individual, the personal qualities, with the situational aspects, what I know about this that I'm looking at now or thinking about, and the experience I bring to bear, seems to be the critical element of judgment. Most often, I must tell you, when I talk to people about this, they say, before they've heard my definition or we've discussed definitions, they say, oh, well, judgment is really important, you know, but you know, it's not something I can define, but you know it when you see it. Now, that seems to be not quite good enough. If it's going to be so important, I think we need to pin it down. And in particular, if we try to get it better, we need to pin it down.
Now that we have some sort of a working definition for judgment, let's start with understanding when it really comes into play. While good judgment is generally useful in life, it is particularly useful in situations which don't have one right answer. Professor Joseph Badaracco of Harvard Business School calls it right versus right decisions in his book Defining Moments, when managers have to choose between two equally right options with different trade-offs. Raghu Anantanarayanan, who's been studying Indic wisdom for many decades, breaks down the concept of Dharma Sankata, which is essentially these right versus right decisions that managers and leaders have to go through.
The Indian idea of leadership has always been somebody who can deal with Dharma Sankata. Okay, Vikramaditya is the original model. Okay, and I'm sure all of us have read Vikramaditya and Vetala, na?
Yes.
Every story is a double bind dilemma Dharma Sankata story. And how he resolves it is what shows his wisdom. Right? To solve a Dharma Sankata kind of situation requires wisdom. Right? It's not other capabilities. It also requires a deep understanding of the situation, of the various forces in the situation and how to balance them. Right? The word mandala, for example, which is the word in India that's used for any, you know, chola mandalam. The word mandala means there are diverse forces that have to be brought into coherence. Now, if you've been in leadership, you know that it's always, always a question of, you know, balancing priorities. Right? Quality versus cost, cost versus delivery, delivery versus, you know, product development or whatever. Right? You're always talking payoffs. Right? And there was one management scientist, I forget his name, who brought in the word satisficing. It's a very interesting term. Yeah. Right? And that is what a Dharma Sankata, you can never have an optimum solution. You can only have a satisficing solution. And if you really have been in leadership situations, you know that neither part of this dilemma is going to go away. You solve it for now, in another context, it's going to reappear in a different way. So wisdom lies in how beautifully you understand this context and how you solve it. Right? In a way that it is most coherent. Mm. That is leadership. Mm. Right? I have a big problem with many of the current ideas of leadership. Right? Every leader knows this here. Right? Long term versus short term. Right? Everything you answer has this kind of, and these are not binaries.
The first problem, however, when it comes to resolving a dharma sankata, is knowing how to frame the problem we have in front of us. If we define the problem wrong, we've lost the plot right there. And it may not be obvious what the problem is. The first insight I want to share around this is to be nuanced about how we frame the problem before we start getting into a resolution. Thomas Wedel Wedelsburg speaks about the elevator problem and how the framing of the problem can change the answer we come up with.
Well, you imagine that you are the owner of an office building and that the tenants in the building, they are complaining about the speed of the elevator. It's too slow. What many people do there is to take the problem for granted. Okay, the elevator is slow. And then they swing into solution mode and say, how do we make it faster? Do we put in a better motor, or, you know, do we have to go out and buy a new elevator for that matter? What a clever landlord might suggest is instead that you put up a mirror next to the elevator. Because, of course, what happens is when people see a mirror, they look at themselves and they fall in love and they forget time. And the underlying idea there is, what problem are you solving? That a mirror is not necessarily a solution to a slow elevator. A mirror is a solution to the problem that people think it's annoying to wait. Mm. So it's a simple example, and it really encapsulates that difference between jumping into solution mode, going in and trying to analyze the problem, which is asking, why is the elevator slow? And then the crucial difference between analyzing it and framing it right, which is the question, wait, is this really about the speed of the elevator? Or is there something else going on? Is there perhaps a better problem to solve?
This is a profound point that Thomas makes. Elevator problem is such a metaphor for so many situations that we encounter. It's critical for us to listen intently to understand the various layers in a problem so that we can articulate it correctly. Unfortunately, thousands of years of evolution have led to our brain struggling to deal with nuance, and it turns out that we are biologically wired to pick the simple-sounding plausible story when we are trying to understand a situation. Jennifer Garvey Berger, author of Unlocking Leadership Mind Traps, speaks about how the human mind, unfortunately, is not wired for nuance and ends up settling for the simple story rather than the nuanced version, which is probably closer to the reality.
The more interconnected the world is, the more issues of simple cause and effect are very unhelpful. So the question about whether this is new or not, humans have always loved this thing. But I think, and it's always had like its downside in an unpredictable space. But a lot of the world has been, while it's been quite unpredictable, it hasn't been so interconnected as it is right now. And so I think the downside of our causal thinking is growing as things get more complex. We see that in the COVID situation, just as we look at different governments trying to figure out what will cause the slowing of the virus without causing the ruining of the economy, right? This is the thing that so many people are, governments are trying to figure out. And as long as you're in a kind of linear way of thinking about the world, you're not going to be able to actually respond to the interconnecting forces, and you're not going to be able to take action quickly enough, really. Or action that's suitable for complexity quickly enough. So you get this strange blend of people talking about COVID-19 as though we really understood the cause and effect of things, when really in this complex world, we couldn't possibly understand what makes Italy the way Italy is and what makes Singapore the way Singapore is. Like, we can just look at the little tiniest features that we think we can control. But even you and I thinking about, like, what's the impact of pollution in large urban places? And does the impact of pollution, does that actually help the immune system, or does it degrade the immune system? Does that help the lungs recover? Does it degrade the possible? Like, we don't know. We don't know. And we may never know. We may never know.
True. And maybe responding to the point about the three different stories for each story. Could you talk for a minute there?
Well, so we kind of fall in love with our own conclusions, and we fall in love with our own stories without even noticing their stories. You can hear it in our language. Like, you hear people say, well, it's obvious that, or it's totally clear that. I hear it in my language all the time. And almost never is it actually obvious, the thing that I'm talking about. And so forcing ourselves to listen to when we have a simple story, like, it's obvious what the government should do here. Completely not obvious what any government should do right now. Completely not obvious. And so when we hear ourselves interacting with a complex set of ideas as though it were simple, then we know that we are in this trap. And so I think the solution there is to be able to construct a series of alternate stories, not to confuse us, but in a kind of almost a scenario planning way, not to try and get the right one, but to try to help us understand that there are these multiple possibilities. None of them are likely to be 100% right. And to help us create a kind of a flexibility of our thinking that will hold us in good stead.
Amy Edmondson of Harvard calls it the naive realism bias, where we have a tendency to assume that all we see is all there is. And that can be a problem.
Yeah, the term was coined by a professor at Stanford named Lee Ross. And it just refers to a fundamental aspect of psychology, which is that we all have the experience of seeing reality. You have that experience. I have that experience. I almost can't shake it, right? I look around and I think I'm seeing the light switch in the door and, you know, the other people in the room or whatever it is. And I think that's just reality itself. I don't think, oh, I'm seeing a picture inside my head that neurons are coming together to create. Now, that it's not that we want to be bogged down by the amazing neurology of perception, but we do want to have a healthy skepticism about what we're seeing so that we're open to the fact that we might be missing something. We're open to the fact that you might see it differently. But because of our naive realism, we tend to think that we're seeing reality and you must see it too. And then we are surprised and disappointed when you see something differently. And it's usually not a happy surprise. And so we sort of think, we then make inferences about the other person that they are not as smart as they need to be, or that they're disagreeable in some way. So in other words, we have this wiring. I like to say, to put it simply, I like to say, it's hard to learn if you already know. And naive realism means we feel like we know, which means I'm right and you're wrong. Which is,
and in a way, I guess it's pronounced in the social media driven world where we are sort of operating in a bubble and in our echo chambers, I'm guessing.
Yes. I mean, I think social media has exacerbated this problem because it's so easy to find people who agree with us that we then are, you know, at risk of just looking for, because we all prefer that. And so we're at risk of just collecting agreement and not encountering enough disagreement and dissent and perspective enhancing views.
The related insight here is that we need to be aware of the vantage point with which we see the situation or the problem, and the pros and cons and the associated biases in the context of the vantage point.
To validate your vantage point, the first question is, how do I assess if I have a good vantage point? As a leader, how do I assess if one of my reports has a good vantage point? So what is the cure for naive realism? And we think first of four ways to describe what a 10 out of 10 in a good vantage point is. And then we have another section on what is it that can distort your view and how to kind of be grading yourself on both of these. The positive one is, you know, is your vantage point, and I'll describe each one, is it clear? Is it at the right kind of resolution or definition? Is it broad enough or narrow enough, or is your altitude right? And it would be, you know, clear. Okay, am I looking at the world with pink rose-colored glasses and I'm thinking everything's going to work out? Of course I'm right. Or are you working with charcoal-colored glasses and nothing's going to work right and you're not going to be happy at this? And, you know, so the emotional tone. Then are you nearsighted? So you're maybe great with tactical things, but not good with strategic. Or you're farsighted. You're really great. You know, here you are at the top of the skyscraper of your career, but people are like little ants and you've lost track with your frontline people. So these are things to be thinking about, you know, rose-colored glasses, charcoal glasses, you know, and are you nearsighted, farsighted? And sometimes with one leader, you will basically, one person's like nearsighted and farsighted, but nothing in between. So that's clear. The next one is basically resolution. Do you need a high definition view? You know, do you need that, you know, 5K super high clear? But we all have an attention budget. So you can blow your wad too early if you're that level of attention to everything. So how do you make the choice of what do I really focus on clearly? And where is it okay to have an impressionistic view? So that's resolution.
I love the point Carol makes about all of us having an attention budget. It's critical for each one of us to figure out the vantage point at which we want to engage with a problem and ensure that we don't either overdo it or underdo it. That's an element of judgment as well in the various things we do. The other element of contextual awareness in a situation is also about discerning the pecking order of the stakeholders around us. This becomes all the more important if there is a change in context that requires us to recalibrate who the key stakeholders are and to what extent they matter. R. Gopalakrishnan, who's written many books, has authored the book Crash, which features 15 high-profile leadership transitions that didn't work out. He speaks about this phenomenon.
If you want to change things in the organization or which you're going to lead or be a leader of, first you have to change yourself. The so-called objective metrics are actually subjective in the sense they focus on increased profits by 20%. Diversify into X or Y, which are all fine. But those depend on the context. So we set targets for various companies in February for the year 2021. Who the hell knew COVID was coming? So the context has changed, and therefore the performance metrics automatically change. Coming to the other part, the invisible part. Boards are not interested only in your achieving objectives. They are interested in how you achieve the objective also. It is stylish to say, just deliver me the result, I don't care how you do it. But in reality, we are interested in how they did it also. If a CEO is slitting a few necks every night to achieve his results, then you have to accept that there's a criminal case building up. So that's what I mean by the soft part. There are multiple stakeholders, you know. You have so far grown in your career thinking I have one boss, if I satisfy him, everything is all right. Your board itself has a chairman and directors who've been around 20 years, directors who've been around 2 years. And then you have your leadership team, your subordinates, if I may use that word. Then you have your stakeholders, your shareholders. You have your allies, you know, suppliers, vendors, bankers. And depending on the way you act and behave, a pecking order emerges. If you're a very strong domain person, say you've been in the auto industry for 30 years, you joined an auto company, then you pick up the phone and start energizing your old network. You know, of some fellow who supplies very good components. That might be misinterpreted in your new environment. You are doing that because you are head of purchase in some other auto company. You don't sort of bring in all your old buddies. But I mean, very strong in recruiting talent, and then you go and fill up the place with people from your old company, or perceived to have done so, even whether you have actually done so or not. And people don't like that. So I use the word pecking order of stakeholders to mean what was your strength until the other day can play out to be a weakness. So while you must have a 360-degree approach to all your stakeholders, without doubt, the angles of the pie keep changing depending on who's the person who's there.
Talking about transitions, the other element worth tuning into often is how the nature of judgment we need to exercise shifts across different contexts. I notice that leaders often think about the skills and the competencies in different contexts, but sometimes don't account enough for the learning curve involved in building judgment in a different space. When Rupa Kudva transitioned from heading a leading credit rating agency, CRISIL, to heading Omidyar Network in India, which was about venture investing and social grants, she had to re-evaluate what she had to learn and unlearn.
I think there's a difference in judgment as a business leader when you are taking business decisions for a business that you are running yourself, compared with judgment as an investor. I think you're one step removed because you're making a judgment about an entrepreneur who in turn has to make judgments about businesses in areas where there is not much data, which are at the frontier of innovation. And so that makes it increasingly, makes it harder in a sense. I feel though that early stage investing is about thinking of the possibilities and figuring out the possibilities and applying judgment to what is the type of business and will this business model and will this entrepreneur succeed? I think that's the judgment we are making. In a rating decision, the judgment is about the risk, you know, what could go wrong in a sense. And in running a company, the judgments involved are a different set of judgments altogether. It's about, competitive strategy. It's about positioning. It's about new products and things like that. So I think the judgments are in three different contexts in that sense. In investing, I feel that initially understanding the world of the startup entrepreneur was important for me to kind of learn how to think as an investor. I think that was the most important part. In terms of commercial understanding of businesses and how the economics of a business work, I think that was less challenging, really. It was more about how the world of technology is evolving and what are these new age entrepreneurs like. I think developing that understanding, I think, was the learning curve.
Got it. And you talk about going beyond data to having that gut or having that sort of instinct or wisdom. How do you build that over time? What's been your approach to strengthening that muscle?
I feel that for me, it happened because of diversity of exposure. I think just the fact that you're exposed to a number of different business situations, business environments, different sectors, is that richness of that exposure and the diversity of that exposure is very important to developing judgment, I think. And I was just fortunate I had it by nature of the work that we did at CRISIL, and the fact that over time CRISIL became a business which diversified beyond ratings into other areas and into geographies and countries beyond India.
When we shift contexts, there are all kinds of biases we are blind to. For instance, I've noticed that when management consultants move from an advisory services context to an industry, not only do they need to pick up new skills, they also need to reset the metronome in their head, which determines the pace at which they play a tune. Pramod Sinha, who was earlier a director at McKinsey, and now over the last several years has played a key role in setting up several educational institutes of repute, including ISB and Ashoka, speaks about the change in the tempo when you move contexts.
Yeah, again, I would say two things. One is that given that you've lived the life of a consultant for such a long time, you kind of live in this belief that whatever you did had massive impact and changed the way a client did things. You assume that whatever you thought of or whatever you came up with actually works in the real world.
Right.
My belief is that most often it doesn't. And when I try, firstly, when you go out into the real world, you don't have the time for that much thinking and consideration and reflection and analysis that goes into a typical consulting report. So you're taking decisions with much shorter lead times, with much less input, and you have to decide and you have to move ahead. And a lot of times things don't work and you have to do a lot more of try it, measure it, fix it, try it, measure it, fix it. You kind of do it that way rather than having a very deliberate strategy for everything. So I think recognizing that you instinctively have cognitive bias, you have decision-making paralysis, that your decisions that you are used to making with a lot more, and which may inform your quick judgment today are actually going to be, by definition, off the mark because they don't factor in the implementation challenges. Just being aware that however smart you may be, don't assume that you know what it is to work in that environment or in the real world is very important. And I think the second thing is really to then go with a mindset saying, listen, I've been living in an ivory tower for 10 years and this is like now taking on my first job. So yes, I bring in great skills and that's a great starting point and a foundation, but honestly, my gaps are really big gaps where I'm actually at a zero. It's not like I've got some partial information. I assume that, you know, I don't know this at all because of the protected environment I've been in. And therefore being, again, very open to saying, how do I learn? How do I learn? Giving yourself time to learn.
Correct.
So one of the mistakes I feel I made is that I was in too much of a hurry when I went and became the CEO of this other company. I wasn't conscious of how important slowing down change is for an organization rather than, you know, I came from a consulting mindset of transformation, PMO banao, launch newish initiatives. People will change, they'll be inspired, I'll inspire them.
And there's a bias for pace. Right?
Yes. Yeah. And then suddenly you realize that this is not a 3-month project, this is not a 6-month assignment, this is not a one-year PMO where you have to actually show that you delivered the cost savings. You're playing a long-term game and there are people involved. There's somebody who's worked in an organization for 30 years and you're saying, hey, this guy doesn't fit into my structure. You can't just get rid of that person because tomorrow you get rid of that person, your owners or your shareholders or whoever, promoters feel like, you know, how did you just fire somebody who was such a loyalist? Do you know what I went through and how he stood by me? How can you just do that? Right? So all kinds of other issues start to play up, which doesn't fit into the framework of an analytic approach.
True.
So that has been my biggest learning, to not be in a hurry. Consulting somehow puts you into this treadmill of 3-month, 4-month projects, right? Everything has to be done yesterday. Things have to be over-delivered, right? To get off this clock and say, hey, this is a long-term game I'm playing. You know, if I'm going to be in this role for 3 years, then let me take my time to listen, get to know people, build credibility, look at how can I build trust, all of those things. And there's no hurry, you know, it's okay. I can deliver the cost savings next year, but this year is really 1 year of induction, getting to know people.
If I translate this to cricket, the calculus of which ball to hit, which ball to leave, is fundamentally different if you're playing IPL versus playing Test cricket. If you're transitioning from one format to another, it's critical to tune into your default tendencies and reset the wiring around this piece of judgment. Just to take stock of where we are in this episode, we've so far spoken about the nuances and understanding the context before we move to decision-making mode. The stakeholders, the silent voices, the biases, and so on. Let's now move to decision-making. One thing that's worth bearing in mind in the context of decision-making is that sometimes not making a decision is also a choice. As a leader, sometimes you're the only one with a 360 view, and it might make sense to wait not because you're idle or lazy or don't have an action bias, but because you choose to be strategically patient. The master of this craft, of strategic patience, was a former Prime Minister P.V. Narasimha Rao, who was recently awarded the Bharat Ratna. Vinay Sitapati, author of Half Lion, Narasimha Rao's biography, speaks about it here.
So I think, well, I'll give you Narasimha Rao's view, which is that he trusted people around him, right? But he also realized that the expert knows only one thing. But a problem may have multiple components. You know, Manmohan Singh understands, you know, tariff reductions very well. Manmohan Singh doesn't know how to get it through the Lok Sabha. Manmohan Singh doesn't know how to get it through the Rajya Sabha, right? The you know, an IFS officer, diplomat will tell you that, look, we need to make overtures to Israel, right? The diplomat doesn't know that you need the political signaling of hugging Yasser Arafat, right? So I think Narasimha's remarkable ability was that he relied on experts, right? But he knew that he alone had the 360 degree view.
And the how part, as you said.
And the how part, right? And the how part requires a 360 degree view, you know? In fact, I don't know whether this is relevant to this conversation, but, you know, my former boss, Shekhar Gupta, would always tell me that, you know, the difference between Indian leadership and Pakistani leadership is that democratic politicians are forced to take the 360 degree view. Whereas Pakistani, you know, leaders, typically dictators, military dictators, are all looking at the army view, army view, army view. And the army view is just one view, right? Musharraf knows how to attack Kargil. He doesn't know how to be a diplomat, right? He doesn't know how the economy works. So, you know, we are in any organization, right? We are going for specialist, right? But the ultimate decision maker has to realize what is good for the entire organization. And that was Narasimha Rao, right? And that's another reason why he felt that even though Manmohan Singh knew more about him than in finance, A.N. Verma, who was a former industry secretary, understood industries very well. K.N. Venugopal, Yugandhar, understood welfare scheme. He was the only person who had the keys to all kingdoms. And decisions required that.
Very, very interesting. And we've spoken a lot about the decisions Narasimha Rao made. And sometimes, even in the book, you talk about the fact that not making a decision is a decision itself.
Yeah.
And Narasimha Rao, in a lot of ways, mastered the art of not making a decision in a strategic way.
Yeah.
So talk to us a little bit about that notion in the context of Narasimha Rao.
See, you know, Narasimha Rao made a lot of fun of, because the typical view of Narasimha Rao was, look, he's a scholar, but he doesn't act. And that's just a straight untruth. As I show in the book, you know, yes, he was a scholar, but at heart, he was a man of action, right? What he also was acutely aware of his political vulnerabilities. So when he didn't act, it was not because he didn't want to act, and not because, not acting was important, but because he just lacked the political ability, right? Sometimes it was that not acting is important, right? Not making a decision is important, right? But very often he just lacked the political ability that he could have made the decision. You know, he could have made the decision to privatize Air India, right? Which today we're trying to do. But at that time, he would have lost his job. So he didn't make a decision on the matter, right? So the stereotype of Narasimha Rao is which comes from that idea, you know, analysis until paralysis. That would be the joke. And the joke was Narasimha Rao knew how to be silent in 10 languages, right? And I think that misses, you know, something at the core of Narasimha Rao, that he was a man of action, right? But he was also acutely aware that, you know, as the book points out, he lacked power. So his genius was he knew where to act, under which political cover, and when he lacked political cover, he would withdraw. And it's a fine art, right? Because most politicians, you would argue, only care about survival. Narasimha Rao cared about survival, but he also cared about other things.
Vinay's book Half Lion on Narasimha Rao is a masterclass in leadership under constraints. Even if we go back in time, Chhatrapati Shivaji, the great Maratha warrior, while known for his bravery, was also known for his strategic patience that Vinay talks about. In the next segment, we hear from Pradeep Chakravarti, a historian and author of the book Leadership Shastra, where he distills some of the leadership lessons from Indian history that we can learn from.
Yeah, I think that's a good point that you raise. And it's not just with Shivaji. You find this with all the leaders who've been truly great. They build large empires. They have known when to strike and when not to strike. And you find this with Shivaji consistently. He was a remarkable survivor. He knew when to fight the Mughals and when not to fight the Mughals, and there were times when he could quietly build an alliance with them and allow them to rule their part and him rule his own part. And even in the way he was, when he was patient, it wasn't this, he was just sitting and watching dance performances or anything like that. He was actually sitting and consolidating his administration. And Shivaji had this remarkable ability to build forts, make those forts self-sufficient and work at a very personal level with the farmers around those forts to build a connection and improve the agricultural productivity. And his ability was also came from constant travel in his country. So he knew the geography of his region so well. One is, of course, it helped him fight the battles with the Mughal and use guerrilla warfare techniques. But in the travel, he was able to build personal connections with each of those people and consolidate administration as well. So multiple lessons from this, Deepak. One is that you need that council of ministers. You need to have patience to know when to strike, when not to strike. Even when you're not striking, how are you consolidating? When you're not striking, are you sitting back and relaxing? Are you consolidating? Are you building personal rapport, not just with your farmers, but with your military people as well?
Hmm. And any particular instance that comes to mind when it comes to Shivaji to bring this to life?
I think I don't know whether I can give you a specific instance. But if you look at the way after he fights the Bijapur forces and he marches over to Konkan and Kolhapur, Panhala Fort capture, for example, is a good example of how he really focused on the patience with which he had worked himself up in the time when he was not fighting the Mughals, and he was able to capture the fort with this newfound connection with the army and with the farmers around the region.
The next thing about judgment is that very often we see it as choosing from options presented to us. I believe a big part of it is actually generative. It is about saying what are the different elements that have not been presented in the option set. There's also a nuance about the stance with which we engage with the problem. Carol Kaufman and David Noble, authors of the book Real Leadership, speak about this notion of having different options with which we engage with the situation.
So let me just set that up, and then Carol can talk about the four stances, because those are that's one way of finding four ways to win. And there's also many other ways to find four ways to win in the book. It's a really crucial thing. But the premise is that because volatility is on an escalating trajectory, we get nonlinear kind of curveballs and obstacles thrown at us all the time. So what we find is that good leaders can identify one way to win. But in many cases these days, you need a backup to that plan and you need a backup to the backup. So that's why we want to have way power, which is multiple ways forward, because the more viable options you have to achieve a goal, again, the more likely you are to achieve the goal. And then Carol can pick it up for the stances.
Right. And there's a lot of research based on this. Many, many studies have looked at it and looked at predicting success based on, do people have this way power? Where does this come from? It comes from the four main reflexes that we all have, which are fight, flight, freeze, and befriend. Befriend is a new one in terms of people understanding it. And that is, you know, if you see a little kid in front of a bus coming on, you don't think whether or not you should save them. You just, it's a reflex to just grab them. We've translated this into what we call the four stances. So if you watch tennis, for example, or even play it, it's not what they do with the arms. It's how they set their legs, the stance they take before. It's a forehand, a different stance for a backhand or close to the net, etc. And that's basically what we think is, what is sort of your default stance that you can take? And then how can you expand it? And the four stances are, in a nutshell, first, you know, lean in, lean back, don't lean, or lean with. So lean in is rolling up your sleeves, really engaging. If there's a conflict, going there. Now, it doesn't mean you lean in a directive way. It means you're actively engaged. It could be edgy. It could be enthusiastic with a lot of zest. It could be with the delicacy of a ballerina or the intensity of a rugby player. So there's many ways, and in the book, we actually have a host of examples and directions that you can take. So that's lean in. Lean back is basically data-driven, inquiry-driven. I'm going to take a lean back. I'm going to look at the topography. I'm going to look at the data. I'm going to be very rational in what I'm thinking and in my choices. If I have to do a reduction in force, I'm not going to be leaping in and doing that. I'm going to really get out my spreadsheets and figure out what's right. Leaning with is leading with caring, concern, nurturance. And if it's at scale, it's culture. If you have a merger and acquisition, you know, your integration, you're going to kind of be thinking people first. So lean in is action first. Lean back is, you know, data first. Lean with is people first. And don't lean at all is reflection first. And the capacity to not lean, which is the toughest of all, requires a decision to be able to tolerate doing nothing for, it could be seconds, it could be moments, it could be a decision. And that would be, so why does that one matter? One reason it matters is the other three are all kind of what your brain is producing. This one is making a reflective space so an idea can like hit you. It kind of opens you up to kind of intuition or kind of new thoughts. One way, simple example is, let's say, okay, so Deepak, you're giving a talk and it's kind of important to you. And maybe it's even being filmed. And then somebody in the audience sneers at you and really has that like, this is so stupid. I can't believe we're wasting our time. Okay. So you can imagine the different stances. You would respond rather differently. So if you're going to lean in, you might say, excuse me, what's going on? Or like, okay, I'm not going to look like a bully in front of everyone, but I'm going to talk to this person after the meeting. Okay. Leaning back. It may be like, okay, what's the data? What might the person be responding to? What are they thinking? What is the best way for me to like interact in this moment? Like, I'm just going to go with the data. Now, leaning with, I'm like, oh no, what did I do? Like, you know, like this person, I've offended them. And I might like then the whole rest of the talk be like honing in on them and making them like what I'm doing. But don't lean is, I'm just not triggered. This person has sneered and it's nearly a non-event for me. I will just go on. I'm reflecting and I don't have to react. So those are the four stances and one way you can think about them?
I think that the not leaning is the most difficult one, as Carol said. And that's something because as leaders, we're all very action oriented. But when you think mm-hmm. about it, it can manifest not just in allowing your intuition to come to the surface or to take a moment to calm yourself, but also sometimes you can just wait and hopefully your team is going to fill that void. You don't always have to act on everything. And, you know, that team should be filling that space in many cases too, rather than you leaning in. And then also, you know, the example of letting the sneer go. Sometimes when there's something, you don't actually have to confront it. You don't have to deal with it. You can just turn aside and let it go right past you. So mm-hmm. it's actually a very powerful stance that's quite underused in the repertoire of post leaders.
Hmm. And you also go on to say that we all need to pick an approach that's consistent with our core self. Can you expand on that in the sense that the stance we take needs to be resonant with who we are? I found that quite intriguing. A part of me was wondering as I was reading that to say, I guess the corollary to that also means that we also need to learn to flex to go beyond our default response. But I was curious to get your sense on that connection.
Well, let me kind of step into that, because I think if you look at the sequence, we first want you to understand what your default response would be. Because again, the whole theme of the book is know when your default is not going to serve you well. So we want you to know, like if you're a lean in person, to know that that tends to be overused. Then of course we want and need you to be genuine as you step into the other stances. So what we do is equip you to be more agile across all those other stances. So we actually show you how to step in more. So if you're a person who finds it difficult to lean with, to connect with people, we show you how to do that. Or if you find it difficult to lean in, we show you how to do that. So all the way through, you are being authentic, or you're growing as a person so that you can be more agile.
Yeah, and the important part is...
Sorry, please.
Just remember that the whole point is for a leader to find that space between stimulus and response. And this is one of the key things in that space. And because we've made it so simple, you know, who do I want to be? You know, what do I want to do? How do I want to read to late? Do I want to lean in, back, with, not lean? We're making it so it can be sort of super quick, laser questions to ask yourself and possible micro behaviors. So on one hand, it's very important to know what your default is and to use your default when that's appropriate, but also to tweak your default. So one of the things we do in the book is we have three chapters based on the options generator. The first one is just about, it's more business, it's more of a business chapter. And it goes beyond that to how you can make more options, more business decisions. Then the second one is how do you use that material in terms of your own development? How quickly or intensely do you take it on, et cetera? The third one is how do you lean in, back, or whatever? And it actually has a series of sections on each one to talk about. You can lean in. Well, how can you lean in with your strengths? How can you lean in with your values? How can you lean, you know, so there's lots and lots of nuance. You can sort of do a totally deep dive. And at the same time, you could do it in seconds.
As we move towards wrapping up the episode, it's useful to think about how we can measure good judgment and how do we discern good judgment from bad judgment. Sir Andrew Lichtman, who we heard from early in this episode, speaks about a feedback loop that we all need to construct for ourselves as we go about measuring the quality of our judgment.
And on a related note, Andrew, you talk about a leader's sort of taking stock of the key judgment calls they take to identify what went well and what went badly. To make it tactical for the listeners, what are some of the behaviors or small habits or things that you see people do to keep a record of the various judgment calls they're making? How do leaders, what sorts of report cards do they use for themselves as they take stock of the quality of judgment over time?
I've got an example from commercial life, or rather, it's somebody who's involved in a government department here, who said at the end of every week, she sat down and wrote down the major decision she'd made in the week. And this was before we hadn't, I mean, she hadn't read anything that I'd written, is it? That, and I, but I would happen to be talking to her, and she gave me this example. And she reflected at the end of the week. It just took, she said, about 15 minutes to say, all right, so what did I do then? And how did it go? And do I regret that? Now, she said, all right, end of the week is a bit short term. You haven't got the answers. But at least it gives you some way to look back on that. Some people, of course, look back at the end of a year and do things like that. Some people take a longer period. The one difficulty about this is that you don't have on this list the things that you didn't do. So you only have the things that you did do. And on reflection, that's something which I'm still having to think how to cope with that. But those are the kinds of examples one has to allow the benefit of reflection from what one has done. And I think that's something where one can learn all the time.
I'm reminded of something that Jack Welch would do. He'd spoken about it in one of his books. I know that a lot of Jack's leadership style is under the scanner these days. But I believe that this particular insight in one of his books is relevant even today. GE used to have a pretty rigorous recruitment process. They would often tabulate how different people rated a candidate at the time of recruitment. And then they tracked the performance of the individual if he or she ended up joining. A few quarters later, they would look at the performance of the individual and reconcile that with the scores given to the person by various people. If you do it systematically enough and long enough, you can quickly figure out which of the panelists has a good sense of judgment around people and who can look ahead of the curve. Such a simple but a robust way of figuring out who has a good sense of judgment around people. The related point I might make here is that very often it's not about reflecting on the choices we made, but often it's also about the choices we never made that can often be revealing as we go about our journey. Dan Pink, author of the book Power of Regret, speaks about how regrets are often the photographic negative of the future we would like to see. Tuning into our regrets can sometime inform a judgment about how we want to move forward.
My view is that if you understand what people regret the most, you understand what they value the most. And what I did is that I went out and collected a lot of regrets from around the world. We have now, at this point, you and I are talking in early March, we're now over 19,000 regrets from 109 countries. It's unbelievable.
Wow.
And what I found is that around the world, people ended up regretting the same four things. Mm-hmm. And that those four, but when people tell you what they regret, they tell you what matters to them. And so if we understand these regrets, we understand what people say makes life worth living. And that was the kind of thing where I was trying to, it's one of the good things, going back to your initial question again, like one of the things I like about being a writer is being surprised. Mm-hmm. And that came as a little bit of a surprise to me because I was trying to make sense of this emotion of regret, going through all of the academic research on regret to say, okay, how does this emotion operate? What does it mean? What does it do for us? How prevalent is it? I also did a piece of quantitative research here in the States, a very large public opinion survey to try to get American attitudes about regret. And then essentially for storytelling purposes, for emotional texture, I wanted to collect a bunch of regrets from around the world. I got way more than I ever anticipated. And those ended up revealing something that surprised me, which is exactly what you say, which is the photographic negative.
This is probably a good place to wrap up this episode. Very often, we see judgment as an activity, but I hope that you see that it's deeply connected to who we are as individuals, what our beliefs are, what our regrets are, what our biases are, and so on. A big part around developing good judgment, needless to say, is about going on a meaningful inner journey where we come to terms with some of the elements that we've discussed. Clearly, there's an element of listening to what's being said and what's not being said. And there's decision making, which includes not making a decision, having creativity around choices, and having a 360 view of the situation. I sincerely hope that you found the compilation useful. If you find this content of value, do take a moment and rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever else you consume the content. Do also consider sharing this with the communities you belong to. A short WhatsApp message to your classmates, friends or colleagues could go a long way in spreading the word and us continuing on this mission of creating content that provokes you and gets you to play to your potential. Whether you want to do it or not, I leave it to your good judgment, which by now I'm guessing is sound. Thank you for listening and your attention, and I look forward to having you in one of the subsequent conversations at the podcast. Bye now.